That was In These Times reporter Jason Vass, interviewed by Shay Maraschino from the Independent Media Center.
You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.
Corporate money and politics was a major theme addressed by many of the speakers at the various rallies. Granny D, a 91-year-old woman who walked across the country last year to promote campaign finance reform, was out in the streets taking on the issue of government corruption.
If we choose to be angry, let it be in defense of our standing as a self-governing people. Let its poison harden us in battle against those who, in exchange for campaign contributions, sell policy and sell access to power, which belongs rightfully to all of us. For how can we serve each other's needs and preserve our very earth if we allow greedy interests to steal from us the reins of our own democracy? There is the issue, my friends, and the theft of an election, but the theft of a democracy. During the Continental Convention, Ben Franklin, I am sure you have heard, looked at a half sun carved on President Washington's chair and said that he had some confidence that it represented a rising, not a setting sun for our country. But we look at that symbol today and think about the condition of Congress, and it might suggest something else. I understood it when I looked up into the Capitol Rotunda on a day I was arrested. Arrested there while reading from the Bill of Rights. For the sun streamed through the high windows. Here is a house that should hold the bright sunlight of our democracy. And it is now turned into a house of political prostitution. There is a house in Washington. They call the rising sun, and it's been the ruin of many a man who bribery has undone.
Granny D speaking at the Vote March rally on Inauguration Day in Washington, D.C. Many of the activists on the street don't see representative democracy as a goal, but rather as an obstacle to real democracy, direct democracy that functions from the bottom up, without an authoritarian hierarchy. Sage, an anarchist activist who also participated in the demonstrations against the IMF last year, talked about his participation in the Inauguration Day demonstration, about being the special targets of the police, and the philosophy that inspires him.
Here with Sage with the Black Bloc. Sage, you want to explain a little bit about where you were at and what you saw happen?
As we were walking up, we kept seeing the police try to block us in the front and then start coming up from the back. For a little while, I thought we had a police escort, but then whenever we tried to turn onto a different road, they totally blocked us off. As more came up from the back, we made some mailbox blockades. And then as we turned onto 14th Street, police just came up, popped out of their vans, started chasing people, started taking out the batons, hitting people, just went up to people, started punching them right in the stomach, started cracking them over the head. and I got out. We came back. The police were just kind of wandering around there for a little while, not knowing really what was going on. And then they just started sporadically chasing us again. And then from that point on, they just locked everyone in and just trapped everyone in 14th Street by 14th and I.
About what time was this?
This is around 1 o'clock.
Well, how many of you guys were there?
Say about 250, maybe 300.
What led up to the police showing up? Like, what was happening, like right before the police showed up?
Just walking down the street, some chants, some radical cheerleading. That was about it, actually. It was quite surprising.
So you guys had a contingent of about 300 people out today?
Yeah. Well,
were there more than that, or was that...
I'll say that would be a general number for the amount of people that were in Black Bloc.
How did you respond to that when the police showed up and started taking all those actions?
When the police first showed up, they were just following us for a bit, and then when the vans pulled up and they hopped out, we immediately just started running up the street because things were kind of getting lagged behind.
You guys were dispersing?
And some of us in the front tried to just move quicker, as to regroup. And then when they came out and started chasing people inside the crowd, things started to disperse.
Was anybody arrested?
We heard of some arrests, but we don't have any confirmed. We heard of more physical beating than arrests, though.
Then what happened after? What happened afterward? Like, how long did this go on for?
They chased us around for about 10 minutes, just in this one area. Some of us that were able to get out walked around a bit, and when we came back, we saw a bunch of American flags in Black Bloc, and we heard that the voter march came up to it already, and then they trapped in that march, and then they just tried to block everyone onto the sidewalk and get everyone out of the street that wasn't initially trapped in the police blockade.
So they created a blockade where you guys were inside of, and they wouldn't let you out, or
right.
and then is that when they were doing the beatings, and was it in
that? They started doing the beatings first, and then they set up the blockade.
Okay.
Because they just started trying to grab people, chase them down, and get them all locked together.
Right. Now, what is Black Bloc? Can you give a little explanation on what you guys are about?
Black Bloc is basically showing anarchist presence at a protest or a rally, and to offer alternative forms of actions that may or may not be going on that day, such as in A16, a lot of people were taking lockdown roles and blockade roles where the Black Bloc stayed mobile to be able to reinforce those blockade areas. And today there wasn't hardly any direct action at all being taken, and we felt like still taking to the streets and watching and showing that there is an anarchist presence here today. The voter march helped us out a bit because the block and the voter march were trapped in together. When people decided to finally go through the police line, they got through, and the voter march continued, knocked down the rest of the barricades, and just continued out. At that point, the police just kind of let everyone go. And
so because you were mixed in with the voter march people, that the police weren't going to take as drastic action as...
I think so. The police were quite passive around that. After the initial beatings and stuff,
yeah,
the police were pretty passive and at times seemed a bit confused. When we went over to try and get to the Justice Department, we got blocked up there, and people were hanging around a bunch of flagpoles with American flags,
yeah,
hanging on there, which got replaced by black and red and black flags, and an upside-down, half-burnt American flag. Before we broke out of the police blockade, one young man got on top of the street signs, started waving the black flag and burnt an American flag up there, and a lot of people, whether they be anarchists or whoever was there, was giving him a lot of support. and stuff too for that, and it really kept the crowd that was locked into the police barricade going, and so that was good.
So what's the statement that you're trying to make as far as to protest the inauguration of Bush?
To protest the inauguration of Bush, well, coming from an anarchist perspective, we believe, well, at least I believe, in a direct democracy where we all make our choices and for our own communities, and we all participate instead of having someone sit in federal government or even state legislation having the almighty authority over what happens, or trying to put the almighty authority over what happens in our own backyards, where we take the action ourselves. And if we want to create a garden, we'll create a garden. If we want to open up housing, we'll open up housing. And we also specifically defied this election because of Bush and the big money and small government. Well, yes, you know, we're smaller the government, the better, of course. But, you know, at the same time, he wants smaller government, but big business, and big business to take over what's ruling going on in our political system. So, as our opposition to capitalism, we feel that this election is especially important for us to be out there.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Sage with the Black Bloc. Thanks a lot.
Civil libertarian and former independent presidential candidate Ron Daniels paid a visit to the IMC radio studio and spoke at length about third parties, activism, and the two-party system. Ron Daniels.
With us now is another independent candidate for president back in 1992, Mr. Ron Daniels, who is the executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights and one of the co-conveners of the shadow inauguration, the Day of Resistance. So how'd it go today, Ron?
Well, I thought it went extremely well, given the weather, which was very inclement, very cold, very rainy. We had hundreds of people who came from all across the country to be a part of this. Several buses came from Detroit, and buses from Raleigh, North Carolina, and Georgia, Florida, New York City. So I thought it was extremely successful. The Reverend Sharpton, of course, was the one who initially called for the march. But he was joined by the Reverend Walter Fauntleroy here in D.C., the Reverend Wendell Anthony from Detroit, and Martin Luther King III with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and of course the Center for Constitutional Rights joined in the effort. So we had a magnificent program, and because the most important part of it was that people clearly were here to resist. They were clearly here to articulate a sense of dissatisfaction with the election. But more important than the dissatisfaction and the opposition, a determination that moving forward, there would be an agenda for change.
So you're one of the leaders of the civil rights movement as it exists today. What direction are we headed? What should people be doing now to get ready for the next 4 years?
Well, I think there are several things we need to be looking for. Number one, we certainly need to not be discouraged by this most recent election, in the sense that we need to get people registered to vote across the board. I've always believed that it's not just the ballot. It's metaphorically, as Malcolm X said, it's the ballot and the bullet. It's freedom by any means necessary. And so a lot of the energy that was generated at the historic confrontation around the World Trade Organization in Seattle, the demonstrations that developed in Washington, D.C., around the IMF and the World Bank and the Democratic and Republican conventions. Those were street that was like street action. And what we need to do is understand that we need to mobilize street action to go with electoral action in defense of our interests and our relationships in this country in terms of our rights. And we also need to use economic sanctions. I mean, we have a hip-hop generation of folk who wear clothes that, by and large, are manufactured by huge multinational corporations that don't give anything back to our communities, who could be influenced, in fact, to take different positions and to pressure politicians around critical issues related to human rights and civil rights. So I think we have to combine these various movements together in a very powerful way, and I think we saw that today when a number of groups joined in the shadow inaugural, the Day of Resistance that was being articulated. By the time we got to the Supreme Court, there were hundreds of people who had come from other demonstrations, knowing particularly that this was a black-led demonstration and that black people had significantly been disenfranchised or disproportionately disenfranchised. That was a powerful signal. They wanted to be a part of that. So I think we have to advance a voter bill of rights. We have to defend the Voting Rights Act. We have to get private money out of elections. We got to see that some 4 million people in this country who have been disenfranchised because many of them were criminalized and now have criminal records, felony offenses, many of them nonviolent offenses. They must have the opportunity to get the ballot back in their hands. We must make sure that there is equal access to media and the debates when we have candidacies like Ralph Nader, who was excluded from the debates. We've got to push to make sure that it's easier to get on the ballot so that third parties can flourish in this country. So we have a broad-ranging electoral agenda, a bill of rights for change. But beyond that, we must also fight for fundamental change in the country. That is to say, we have to be about the business of breaking beyond just the bureaucracy of changing the machinery and all that. The real deal about this week, and which connected very nicely with Martin Luther King Week, is a vision for a new society. That's what many people are marching for. That's why we're checking corporations. That's why we want to transform corporations. That's why we want to fight for greater democracy in this country. Because we'll never, ever really be free of the machinations of the Bushes and others until we have a more open system, which is in fact controlled by the people in this country. We don't have that now. And so our vision is tied to this new sense, not a new sense, but a sense of economic and political democracy.
What do you think about the fact that, well, we heard earlier that the many members of the Congressional Black Caucus essentially boycotted the inauguration? Is there a sign of splintering within the Democratic Party? Or?
Well, I know what I think is this. There's tremendous dissatisfaction, and I think this is a very, very critical moment. Because many, when you saw the Congressional Black Caucus with Maxine Waters and Jesse Jackson Jr. stand there at the day of the certification of the Electoral College vote, and when Florida came up and they rose to protest the Florida vote, they couldn't get one Democratic senator to join them. So there are many black Democrats who are feeling abandoned by the Democratic Party. The fact of the matter is Al Gore did not stand up for black folks, for disenfranchised black voters in Florida. I mean, he played a race-neutral kind of game. He did not. He could have come out, for example, in a very instructive way to say, we can't tolerate this because black people, Haitians and others, particularly black people, have been disenfranchised before. So we're in our country, we're about to let this happen again. He could have exercised leadership, but he was afraid of hostilizing and antagonizing others, and so therefore he didn't do it. Indeed, when we look at the nomination of Ashcroft, the Republicans are standing lock stock behind this Confederate sympathizer. Lock stock. The Democrats, Paul Wellstone. I mean, Wellstone is somebody I know from the Rainbow Coalition before he was a senator. You know, when I was deputy campaign manager for Jesse Jackson and with the Rainbow Coalition, I went to Minnesota. That's where I first met him. Paul Wellstone is going to support Ashcroft, Torticelli in New Jersey. I mean, if the Democrats were lock stock in opposition because black folks across this country mobilized in unprecedented numbers. 89% of the eligible voters in Miami-Dade County came out and voted. So, as Malcolm X said, black people put the Democratic Party first, but they put us last. And so there is tremendous dissatisfaction about that, and I was very proud of the Congressional Black Caucus that they stood up and walked out of that chamber, that they are indeed boycotting this inaugural, because we have an illegitimate presidency. We have an illegitimate regime born of the disenfranchisement of people. And so there's no time. This is not business as usual. We must be in a posture of being angry, being frustrated, being willing to fight. But we have to channel it in a way that it, in fact, will produce positive and constructive change into the future. And that's what I think we saw today. And we saw all these different groups coming together so that the world can see that, in fact, we're not satisfied. I mean, the image that I understand that was cast on many television programs, seeing the Supreme Court absolutely run with, you know, people, a human chain around the Supreme Court, that image not only went to the rest of America, it went to the whole world. And so what can Americans say? What can they say to the rest of the world when it sees the Supreme Court on inaugural day, with surrounded by a human chain? That's the image and message we got to get out. We've got to keep fighting, got to keep pushing. And this was a glorious day in history, the people's, as Howard Zinn would say, the people's struggle. It's a glorious day today.
Yes, indeed. We're talking with Ron Daniels, the executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights and one of the co-conveners of the shadow inauguration.
And by the way, let me just say this. The other thing that was a great pleasure today was to see Arthur Conoy. The Center for Constitutional Rights was founded by people who went to the South. They were mostly young white intellectuals and radicals and liberals who really, believe in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and really recognized that Southern apartheid in Mississippi and across the South was wrong. They came at the behest of Fannie Lou Hamer, Ella Baker, Bob Moses, Jim Foreman, and others to come and become a part of that struggle. And they got a baptism because they really were brought under fire. Today, standing with us was Mrs. Carolyn Goodman, the son of the Goodman, young Goodman who was slain in Mississippi. Ben Cheney apparently could not make it, but had intended to come. We had other SNCC workers who had been there. People gave up their lives in the Freedom Summer of 1964. And so to have Arthur Conoy, who is a legendary figure because it was Conoy, it was Kunstler, it was these young radical lawyers who went into court and were able to use those Reconstruction amendments to in fact, push the court system to validate the right of black people and others to have demonstrations and to have boycotts and so forth. So for him to be the honorary Chief Justice today, was really great. And to have the Mrs. Goodman be an honorary jurist and other people be a part of that was a magnificent scene. The imagery and symbolism of that, it was very powerful today. But not just the symbolism of it. You had a lot of history of struggle. And an old generation, Arthur Conoy is now in his 80s. You got people in their 50s and their 60s. And then you have young people, who were coming. Some of them were demonstrating for the first time. I was in the march, and a young man was there with his daughter. And he was explaining to his young daughter as we marched, the significance and meaning of it. And that's why it seems to me we have a tremendous possibility for the future. Many of the people who responded to the actions today, at least from the African-American community, are people who've never been involved in anything before. And so that's very hopeful. I stood yesterday with a young woman who just got involved around the IMF World Bank demonstration. She looks in her 20s, but now she's almost a seasoned veteran after 6 months, and she's on the front lines. The work that you folks are doing here in terms of the Independent Media Center and the work that you're doing certainly is a new development that's powerful, that's positive. So they got the corporate media, it's monopolized, it's conglomerized, it's homogenized, and then you folks show up. So we got to come in the African vernacular in the Nguzu Sapa, the seven principles of the black value system, it's called Kuumba, creativity. We have something they don't have. So no matter how hard they come at us, no matter how hard they try to stop us, we've got Kuumba. We'll be creative and we're going to win.
Ron, I have a question for you. What is your view of the Republicans' tactic of pushing forward black leaders or so-called black leaders such as Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, and tactics such as, for example, Medgar's brother sitting next to John Afcroft during the hearings? And what is your vision of the upcoming next 4 years? And how would one combat this obvious use of so-called figure leaders, black leaders, to project a different image of the Republican Party?
But I think it's important to say two things. Number one, the Republicans are going to work very hard to peel off about 15-20% of the black vote. If they can get back to the levels of the black vote of the era of Nixon and Eisenhower, they'll be very successful in maintaining power for quite at least that level of power. I think the important lesson to be learned not only from Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice and others is and Clarence Thomas, is that today the coalitions we're building are not just about skin color. They're really not just about gender or sexual orientation or any of those issues. I mean, Sandra Day O'Connor is on the Supreme Court. She's a woman. However, her politics are not our politics. It could very well be a lesbian or gay person on the Supreme Court. But if their politics is not a politics of expansion. I mean, imagine the irony of a strict constructionist president like Bush touting diversity. For me, that's when diversity is diverse. They never fought for civil rights. They never fought to abolish slavery, that side. They never fought for labor. They never fought for any of the things that our side has fought for historically in terms of expanding democracy. So we have to understand that it's no longer and should ever, never have been about whether one is a woman or a man or a lesbian or gay person or a black or Latino or Asian in and of itself. Now, of course, I'm not saying that we're not fighting against discrimination and liberation, but the point is, skin color is not enough, because Clarence Thomas is no Thurgood Marshall, and we need to know the difference between Clarence Thomas and Thurgood Marshall. We need to understand the differences between a Colin Powell and somebody like Dick Gregory, who is opposed to the kind of militaristic tactics that a Colin Powell is about. So it's a veneer, it is window dressing, if you will, and not too many black people are actually fooled by it. But this is a concerted effort by the Republican Party to create talk show hosts, people like Armstrong Williams, and you know, to invest them, to create all kinds of folks to endorse their politics. So that's why, again, I call it the fallacy of skin politics. You know, we're not about the business of simply having black faces exchange places with white folks in old places, because that does not necessarily equal empowerment.
And what is your view of, let's say, this new phenomenon of technology meeting the media, meeting the people, let's say a people's newswire such as the IMC, and what would you say to technology-oriented companies that's supporting these efforts, and how could one bridge the gap of this so-called digital divide, and what is your vision of the next coming 4 years, and particularly with view to the Internet as a use of a communications tool?
Well, I think one of the things that's happening is, if we can, in fact, if committed people like yourselves who are committed to democracy are finding ways and means to extend and stretch this media so that average ordinary people can use it, it means a lot. When I ran for president in 1992, the first phase of that campaign was run out of my basement. I would go to Iowa to campaign 1 month, and 2 months later I would go back to Iowa and they would say, "Oh, are you still running?" Well, today would be a lot different, because with the Internet, I mean, at least I could put out a message, you know, saying I was running. I mean, so the world, there's a whole new revolution that's been created. And I think that it will take a concerted effort on our part to try to fight against the Bushes, if you will, to try to expand opportunities in this regard. They're going the wrong way. We just had a decision come down, the Supreme Court decision, saying that the media does not have to extend opportunities in an affirmative way to women and minorities. It's going the wrong way. But, you know, I mean, that's the nature of the struggle. We have to continue the fight. And in the meantime, we have, you know, pirates out there everywhere. And the Center for Constitutional Rights has been involved in helping to defend the right to pirate radio and whatever, and creative, innovative ways of getting the word out. So, yes, there is a digital divide, but, of course, people like yourselves are helping us to bridge that divide. And there's a whole new revolution taking place that they never, ever anticipated. And that feels good.
Ron, what are some of the major battles in terms of legislation that you see coming up? For instance, we're going to see an attempt to expand NAFTA as the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas. We'll probably see a battle over Star Wars. What other concerns of the community? What's going to mobilize the community?
Well, I think there's several things. The environment is certainly one. I mean, these people are shameless. I mean, they're not even in yet. But Cheney, I mean, Chief Executive Officer Cheney, and the oil barons are already trying to move on the Alaskan shelf, and they're trying to peel back Clinton's sort of meager efforts, though somewhat significant, to try to preserve parklands and whatever. So we're going to have to fight on that front. And one of the things we have to fight about, it seems to me, is we have to wage a struggle for people to understand what this really means. See, the American people have got to come to understand that there should be no contradiction between clean air, clean water, having good energy, avoiding the kind of situation we have in California, and having a sustainable economy. That we don't, I mean, Martin Luther King talked about it. We cannot put profit and property over people and the environment. I mean, we're dying. This is, I mean, the world is dying. And we have to be able to convey that message to larger numbers of people in a much more effective way. So that's one of the battles we have to fight. Question of the minimum wage. The question of really fighting for what I call a domestic Marshall Plan to provide massive resources to the urban areas and the rural areas where poor people live. Being in a position to fight for universal health care. I mean, we got to continue to remind the American people that the United States is the only country in the West, only Western industrialized nation that does not have access to health care for all its people. 40 million people who have no health care. 3 to 6 million people who are homeless. And then there's the question of education, and this is another major battle. I'm not sure that simply teaching kids how to master a quantitative test is in and of itself progress. I want critical thinkers. I don't want automatons who can spew out, you know, some quantitative memorized set of facts and figures. Can you think? You know, I mean, or otherwise you have people like Bush who presides over a killing machine in Florida and thinks nothing about it. So we want people who can think. So education is going to be a key battle. The struggle to keep the public space open to all of the people, of all the sons and daughters of all the people who live in this country, as opposed to privatizing, as opposed to vouchers, and as opposed to these private charter schools, or the use of private money to really prop up these right-wing religious institutions. And so we have to confront this issue of education head-on. The prison, jail, industrial complex has got to be one of the biggest problems that we face. The war on drugs, as the brothers and sisters in the ghettos and the barrios and the reservations say, is a war on us. Yeah, that's where racial profiling comes from. And we have thousands upon thousands upon thousands, 22,000 people in the state of New York alone for nonviolent drug offenses. The huge disparity between crack cocaine and powdered cocaine, which disproportionately therefore affects people of color. We've got to tackle these issues. The death penalty. You know, we're beginning to make some progress when a Republican governor, Ryan, out in Illinois says, look, I may be for the death penalty, but I cannot favor a system, you know, which in fact is sending innocent people to death. I'm opposed to the death penalty, period. But I mean, I think it's progress, but at least some people are saying that we ought to have a moratorium. So there are plenty of issues that we have to fight for. But what we have to understand more than anything else is this. We must articulate a vision. And then we must organize the unorganized. The biggest political party in America today is not the Democrats, it's not the Republicans, it's non-voters. And so we have to organize them. And you don't organize non-voters simply by showing up every 2 years. You have to have a party of a new type that's engaged in the day-to-day struggles of people around housing, around health care, around the question of the education of their children, around safety concerns that people have, around the environment. And then when you have that kind of participatory party where you're engaged and you're inviting people to become a part of the discussion, a part of the process of defining the agenda and the goals and aspirations and having them expressed and inspiring them to understand that we are the leaders we've been looking for, that they too can step forward to be the council person, the commissioner, the whatever. Then we're going to begin to break this thing open, and we're going to begin to see participation in the electoral process, 75, 80, 90%, as you see in other countries. But we have to do more than that. We have to absolutely say that we will use any and all means. We have to send thousands of people to jail. If we have to boycott, as we did around grapes in support of the United Farm Workers, we have to pick a target. We can't do everything at once. Pick a vulnerable target and break a corporation's back. And when we do that, they will send a signal to the rest of them, these people are serious. So you got to vote, march on ballot boxes, march in the streets, use civil disobedience, use economic sanctions, use whatever means are at our disposal in order to advance a progressive vision for change. And that's the key word. People must understand that we may be ragtag sometimes. Sometimes we may seem to be crazy in what we do. But at the end of the day, what we're fighting for is an expansion of democracy and to make it a more just society, a more just world. That's key. And when we do that, some of the people who think we're strange will begin to join our side.
You know, a lot of people believe that the Republicans and Democrats are so closely aligned in terms of being backed by corporate paymasters carrying a corporate agenda. But clearly within the Democratic Party, there seems to be a split that falls down along race lines in many ways. The Congressional Black Caucus has the most progressive voting record of any bloc in Congress. Are we going to see some kind of leadership come out of that and challenge the Democratic Leadership Committee from within, and the primaries coming up in a couple years?
Well, I was just at a meeting yesterday. It was called the the Progressive Challenge, which was organized by the Institute for Policy Studies, the Nation Institute. And there were a number of people there. There were members on the Progressive Caucus and the Congressional Black Caucus, Hispanic Caucus. So I think there's going to be an energizing of the liberal, progressive left wing of the Democratic Party, and I think that's positive. And when I was there yesterday, I challenged them to connect that to the grassroots. We need civic engagement, civic participation, conferences, workshops, conventions at the grassroots level. And we need to see a congressperson, a senator, a prominent person like Danny Glover or Susan Sarandon or people that look up and they or rap artists who will come and be a part of that process, because it provides the legitimacy for relatively unknown organizers who are struggling in their communities trying to get people out. But if they know that you've got a noted rap artist like Mos Def or somebody coming through, you know, or Dead President or whatever, that helps to inspire them to come out. So I think we're going to see great energy in that regard. And what I said yesterday, and I've said throughout this last week as I've been traveling the country, we also have to bridge the split on the left liberal progressive spectrum. There's some people who want to continue to blame Nader for the loss of the election. It's nonsense. Nader had a right to run. We needed Nader to run. I'm only disappointed we didn't get the 5%. Because we have to create a situation where people can vote for what they believe in, where there can be a political party, a political force that unapologetically speaks for the vast majority of people of color, of working people, of women, of lesbian and gay folk, you know, who are on the progressive side of history. And that's what I think the Greens were attempting to do. I think that's what Nader's voice was about. It was flawed. I had criticisms of Nader. I think Nader made a number of critical mistakes. Nonetheless, he was head and shoulders the best candidate, barring none, in this race. And so I can't allow people to criticize Nader for, as if he cost Gore the election. I mean, for one thing, Gore couldn't carry his own state. Gore could hardly carry a conversation. It's difficult, you know what I mean, to do that. So we can't have that kind of split on the left. And so we got to find, we got to have at least a third force on the left. And in the final analysis, it means the Greens emerging and other political formations emerging means that there'll be somewhere for those disaffected Democrats, those disaffected Black Caucus members and Hispanic Caucus members and Progressive Caucus members to go. The Greens now on the ballot in about 10 states. They're going to continue to expand and grow. The contradictions they need to work on. But nonetheless, you can't take a few contradictions. I couldn't take the points of disagreement I had with Nader and then dismiss him totally. And this is what we often do. We take differences and we expand the differences as if I agree with Nader. I agree with Nader and his platform. Our agreements were much greater than the differences that we had. Differences were significant, but nonetheless, I couldn't abandon him simply because we had these differences. We have to mature enough, as they have on the right. You know, I mean, when Dole ran for president, he claimed that he wasn't too cool with, I forget the radio, the very, very conservative talk show host down in West Virginia who was involved in one of the scandals. But he went to Virginia and they patched it up. You know, they patched it up. So we have to do the same thing. On the left, liberal, progressive wing of the movement, we have to find ways to conduct what I call operational unities. What are the projects that we can work on together? We argue about our differences, but let's find 2, 3, 4, 5 things that we can unite around and build around and help to push forward to get more people to join our cause, because there's more of us ultimately than there are of them. But we'll never be able to congeal it into a powerful movement unless we're able to conduct, to do what I call operational unity.
One of the things you mentioned earlier was the environment as a defining issue, and that may be, judging from what happened to Newt Gingrich and his attempts to roll back the environment in terms of legislation. So that may be a wedge into dividing the Republican Party from within. There is a group called Republicans for the Environment that are against the Norton nomination, for instance. So as you say, as you suggest, we need to unify our side. We also need to plant a couple of wedges and drive them in and not be on so much on the defensive, which is sort of the mood in the progressive community right now. We are on the defensive. And do you see any other opportunities to go on the offensive here? I mean, it's tough to figure the opportunities
well,
for that. But
it is going to be difficult, but I'm optimistic. I mean, who could have predicted Seattle? I mean, who could have predicted that Seattle would develop? Why did Seattle develop? It developed because of years and years and years of political education, of thousands and thousands and thousands of leaflets, progressive professors on university campuses, progressive teachers in high schools and elementary schools, Pacifica radio network when it's in its right mind, all kinds of good stuff. I mean, you understand what I'm saying? It's that cumulative effect. You'll never know when it's going to break. And a hip-hop generation and a whole new generation of countercultural musicians, artists, and poets. I mean, all of this stuff is like swirling around out there.
What do you see when you look around you in the studio? What do you see when you look around you in the studio? You're speaking of that.
Well, no, I see a lot of energy. I see a positive revolution, frankly. I mean, it's very exciting to see, people who are taking the technology and who understand that the technology is a weapon that can be used for positive change. I mean, I really see that. And it's a huge new development, and it's very positive. And I'm an activist. I've been out here now for more years than I want to admit. I'll hang around a little while longer. I'm ready to share the torch, not entirely give it up. But I must say that it lightens my step. It gives me greater energy to know that there's so many dynamic young people who are coming onto the scene, who are about the business of taking the torch. And as I have this theme about finishing the unfinished American democracy, perfecting the imperfect American Union, and I see the next generation of people coming on. You know, Martin Luther King, the night he was assassinated, or the night before he was assassinated, he rose to speak, and he said, "I may not get there with you." It's a brother named Ralph Featherstone who once said, "To be revolutionary is to know what time it is in history and to do something about that." I may not see the culmination of centuries of struggle, but on the other hand, all I have to do is my part, and now I feel more confident that having done my part as best I know how, there's a whole lot of righteous troopers coming behind me, righteous, positive soldiers who are going to carry it forward. Sounds like good dialectics to me. inside of every thesis, there is a contradiction, and so we have to use those contradictions as best we can.
We encourage our listeners to call in at 202-797-1280. If you have a question for Ron Daniels, please call us, 202-797-1280.
Yeah, once again, just call into Studio 2412 here in Washington, D.C. That's 202-797-1280. And we'll be continuing this broadcast and continuing voicing our opinions. We invite you to voice your opinion.
Well, again, as I said, this is a great experience for, I've been involved. I had my own television talk show for 19 years. I hosted a talk show called Night Talk for about 8 months. And then, of course, to have this experience is a new experience, and I'm very excited about it.
Thank you. This is one of the organizations we intend to continue.
Right, that's good.
Once again, I'm just wondering, it's a great concern of mine. I'm looking at this right-wing Christian coalition that is pushing for Ashcroft and pushing for many other people who are here right now to be allowed on the scene. And I think of people like Norton, who says, "I'm a conservative and a conservationist," as if that could be something that could be a simultaneous state of existence. So in my opinion, it isn't. And I'm wondering, what's your view on this divergent group coalition of forces that's sort of rallying itself against these quite well-organized right-wing people that have been massively funded by the Christian organization?
Well, Eldridge Cleaver, the Black Panthers had a lot of good things to say, and Eldridge Cleaver, when he was in his right mind, had some good things to say. And he once said, "The power of the people is greater than the man's technology." And what I see now is the power of the people is indeed greater than this behemoth that you talked about, these forces that are aligned against us. And in fact, that we have the capacity to take the technology, which is a key question, strategic question at the level of vision. There's nothing wrong with the technology. What we're finding is that you're taking that technology and using it and putting it in the hands of the people so that people have power that they would not otherwise have. So, again, I think it's very positive. I think it's very powerful. I'm convinced that we will win. Again, it may not be in my lifetime, but we are going to win because we have the right vision. We have the right values. We have to learn how to connect with people in popular language. We have to learn how to deal with them one-on-one, person-to-person, to be, you know, like, sometimes the revolution has been too harsh. You know, you see brothers and sisters walking down the street and, you know, and they look like they're angry and mad at somebody. We got to learn how to humanize this thing a little bit, too, you know.
Exactly.
And, you know, when people can party together, you know, they can stay together, you know. And so I always like to see, be with people who also can have a good time. As I see people here, there's joy in the room here. Everybody's smiling. Everybody's, you know, it's a lot of energy. A lot of good stuff is going on. That means people are optimistic. Revolutions are not made of despair. Revolutions are made on rising expectations. That's why Jesse Jackson's phrase that seems a little trite is not trite at all. When he says, keep hope alive, revolutions are made, reform and revolutions are made when people are hopeful, when they believe that things ought to be better and can be better. That's what makes a man or a woman stand in front of a tank in China. I've seen it in rebellions where people would stand up in the face of death and somehow not even and be oblivious to the danger because there was hope and a promise that things could be better. So you folks are contributing to it. I'm happy you're here, and you're going to keep hope alive, and we're going to keep winning.
That was Ron Daniels, Executive Director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, speaking with the IMC radio team.
J20, A Harbinger of Things to Come, by Daryl Lamont Jenkins, an anti-racist activist from New Brunswick, New Jersey, as seen on the DC Indie Media website. A few weeks ago, Rush Limbaugh was reading the press release about the then-upcoming inaugural demonstrations from the International Action Center, and after he alerted his listeners to how certain people were planning to disrupt the festivities, he capped it all by saying, quote, "I hope they get what's coming to them," unquote. That hope dimmed when all was said and done. 35,000 people came out to D.C. on January 20th, and the overwhelming majority was there to denounce George W. Bush, the first president to win a majority of 5-4. It was the largest inaugural protest since President Nixon's second inauguration in 1973, and quite possibly the most volatile. The morning began with a band of right-wingers that held a rally on the steps of the Supreme Court. The gathering of about 100 were led by the Northern Virginia GOP and the new right-wing group Loud Citizen, who promoted the rally on the internet. Among the speakers was David Horowitz, who allegedly used to be a left-wing radical in the 60s, and now is a conservative who fancies himself someone who exposes the left. In fact, he made the distinction that it is the left, not liberals, that are the enemy of his America. Also, a rather inarticulate black conservative by the name of Jesse Lee Peterson also spoke. If there was anyone who embodied the modern-day step and fetch it, it would be this guy. Some of the conclusions that he has made in the past are, for example, deducing that most black Americans are immoral and that Jesse Jackson is a wicked man. All one got out of his speech was how he loves George Bush, how the black community allegedly supports Bush, and oh yes, buy his book. Then there was Jim Parmalee, the head of the Northern Virginia GOP. He framed his little rally as an antithesis to the massive one planned against Bush, and he wanted to take a particular shot at those ralliers. When we saw how many left-wingers were coming out to protest America, we thought that it was time to draw a contrast, he said about those he called the, quote, puppet masters, unquote, because they are the folks who bring out the big puppets of Uncle Sam and burn them. The people who like to bring out caricatures of America's leaders. These folks, it's time for them to go, Parmalee continued. It's time for the folks who busted windows in Seattle and tried to overturn police cars. It's time for them to go. Not long after he made these remarks, a group came along to remind them that these folks were not going anywhere. The only thing they could do in response was chant, "Get a job and take a bath." And one rightist felt the need to inform his group that the group of protesters was comprised of communists and Free Mumia radicals. If Jim Parmalee was not convinced that his call for the leftists to go was unheeded, he had more reminders throughout the day. During the inauguration, two streakers tried to crash Bush's ceremonies. Al Sharpton held a shadow convention at the same time Bush was being sworn in, and along with the 2,000 that joined him, declared that there will be a watchful eye on his presidency. The radical cheerleaders spent the day doing routines supporting anarchy and denouncing Bush. And if Parmalee was still not convinced, there was no question at all after those same detractors made their displeasure known during the parade. Bush ran a gauntlet of people who were against him and everything he stood for, and particularly people who will not accept his presidency as legitimate. He stayed in his limo as tomatoes and eggs pelted the car. Flags and dollar bills were burned by protesters as representative of a system that they rejected. A stylized flagpole with Navy flags adorning it became a target as some protesters scaled the pole, took down the flags, and hoisted syndicalist, anarchist, and inverted American flags, much to the joy of the assembled demonstrators. Then the fun began. At this point, the police felt it was time to bust some heads. They surrounded the pole while the demonstrators were still on it. They were not arrested, however, possibly because they stage-dived into the crowd. The police tried to advance toward the crowd, but the protesters pushed them back. There were some fights with the police, and some of the police, as well as some of the protesters, sustained injuries. There was another development that might have upped the ante for future demonstrations. There was a communication among right-wingers that some of them were going to take on the protesters, that materialized in the form of a man who was masked but then began to pepper spray the crowd. At first it was thought that he was a cop, but questions were raised after the police nabbed him and detained him like the other demonstrators. Local media on the scene confirmed the fact that he was not a police officer. Bush is president now, many say fraudulently. He will not simply coast for 4 years. The racism, gentrification, anti-environment, and anti-poor ideas that the conservatives have planned for America will not be tolerated. This piece is written on the Roe v. Wade anniversary, and Bush was warned not to threaten the abortion rights of America's women, and it will be a warning he had best heed. It is going to be both an exciting and perilous time for all Americans, and many would not have it any other way. The day was capped by a man muttering to himself as he walked to the metro from the parade, quote, "America is a powder keg just waiting to explode," unquote. Anyone got a match? That was J20, A Harbinger of Things to Come, by Daryl Lamont Jenkins, an anti-racist activist from New Brunswick, New Jersey, as seen on the DC Indie Media website, dc.indymedia.org.
This report from the Indie Media Newswire somehow seems like a fitting conclusion to G.W. Bush's Inauguration Day. It's written by Jules Boykoff and Kaya Sand of Washington, D.C., editors of The Tangent, a zine of politics and the arts, and it's titled Scatological Torture. Washington, D.C. We always knew that corporate and U.S. military interests were intricately linked, but who knew it would come to this? When protesters attempted to use portable toilets at Freedom Plaza at 14th Avenue in Pennsylvania, they were denied access by military personnel standing guard who refused to offer an explanation. Almost all of the toilets went unused as people jigged around in panic. When pressed further, the military representatives said they had a right to ban people because the toilets were owned by a private company. They would not explain why tax dollars should fund the whims of this unidentified company, nor did they even divulge whom they would allow to go to the bathroom. Meanwhile, protesters had to cross police checkpoints to find a restroom and undergo yet another police search to re-enter. That story sharply illustrates a quote from the late anarchist activist author Edward Abbey. No tyranny is so irksome as petty tyranny. The officious demands of policemen, government clerks, and electromechanical gadgets.
One day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone. But that won't be my end.
Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
And spread it out.